From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.
And let's get right to more reaction to last night's resignation of Michael Flynn as President Trump's national security advisor. In his first public reaction, President Trump tweeted, "The real story here is why are there so many illegal leaks coming out of Washington? Will these leaks be happening as ideal on North Korea, etc.?" Flynn resigned last night as questions mounted about the telephone conversations he'd had with the Russian ambassador to the U.S. while President Obama was still in office, and also questions about who in the Trump administration knew what when about what Flynn said. In late January, the Justice Department warned the Trump administration that Flynn had mischaracterized his communications with the ambassador. Before that, Vice President Pence defended Flynn and backed the claim that Flynn never discussed U.S. sanctions against Moscow with the Russian ambassador. Jim Walsh is Here Now security analyst. We now know he did, Jim. So the Trump White House warned a month ago. There are transcripts of those conversations that Michael Flynn had with the ambassador. Your thoughts for someone at that level, Michael Flynn, not knowing that?
Yeah, that, you know, I have to admit that in an effort to achieve some escapism, I've been binge-watching PBS mysteries, including Poirot. And I think we have a mystery here. The strangest thing to me is the notion that he, as a former top-ranked intelligence official, would have a conversation with a Russian ambassador and either think, no, that's not going to be recorded by at least two parties, the Russians and the Americans, or think, I know that, but I don't care. So, you know, I know. I've never worked for the government. When I talk to an Iranian or North Korean ambassador, I assume there's at least one, probably more than one party who's recording my conversation.
Well, I think you'd record it just for posterity.
Exactly. But, so that in turn raises the question of, you know, we're early days, so it's wrong to speculate. But could he have had that meeting thinking that he was being asked to have that meeting? And right. Therefore, you know,
set up, because one of the questions is, I guess one of the reasons that he was forced to step down is that the Russians can now blackmail him. If he says, I did not talk about this, they have it.
Yeah, I think also, and as you pointed out, this has been, I mean, that's a possibility and it's serious. But the White House has known this about this for a while, has only acted now. You know, you get rid of someone either because they've crossed some line that is uncrossable, or because you think this story isn't going away and this is just – you're just going to bleed to death over time. And I would guess that the White House came to some sort of conclusion about both those questions, but certainly on the second, the Russian thing is going to continue. You saw that CNN reported exclusively over the weekend that – remember that file, that crazy file making all those allegations about communications with Russia that the former British intel guy? Well, it turns out the intel community has been able to verify some pieces of that dossier, which ones haven't been specified. But that's just another way of saying this Russian thing's going to go on for a while, as you and I have talked and as I predicted. And that means this was going to continue to be a distraction.
This is the British former agent that was collecting material and ended up having material about Russia's involvement in the U.S. election.
Exactly.
And he has now gone into hiding.
Yes.
And you're saying there's some
– well, it's just going to – this story isn't going away. Right. And Flynn was going to be at the center of it. So they had to make a decision. We need to cut bait on this.
What's the impact of it, though? First of all, does it make it impossible for President Trump to soften sanctions against Russia if it seems that there might have been a promise to the Russians of that before he even took office? And how else might it impact American security?
Yeah. Let me start with the second one. I don't know what position Mr. Trump will take on sanctions over time. But I guess my concern is the national security decision-making process. And there's always some upheaval in the early days, and every president goes through a shakeout period. Of course, this is an administration that starts with less foreign policy experience than others. It's been slow to get its people vetted and in place. Some people have decided to do other things with their lives rather than stay. And the reporting that there are problems. And meanwhile, you know, every day there's a new issue. We had today there's a report that the Russians have violated the INF treaty. So I worry, you know, on the one hand, you want them to get it right. So if cutting Flynn means that they can get this improved and done, great. But you worry that this may also just be another step in the process that is sort of a mess right now.
Look, as you said, early days, but there are still a lot of unanswered questions, including In that phone call, does Flynn say that Donald Trump, who hadn't been inaugurated yet, has authorized him to say something about sanctions being lifted? But what do you, just in the few seconds we have, for the cynical among us, and there are many on both sides of the political aisle, for people who say, this kind of thing always happens, does it? How big is this? Before they're in office, perhaps promising to lift sanctions?
Well, every administration has shakeups and problems in the early going. So I would say that's not unusual. I do think there was this whole period in between the election when he took office. Was he playing president early? You know, there's only one president at a time in the United States, and you're not supposed to undermine the one who is currently in office, even if he is leaving. That really seemed to be a big question during that period. This is consistent with that, and therefore I think unusual, certainly unusual.
Yeah. Jim Walsh, Here and Now security analyst, also with MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, lawyers are arguing two major trials today that concern two separate standoffs between federal agents and armed protesters. In Oregon, four people face conspiracy charges for their role in last year's 41-day occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. The leader of that standoff, Eamon Bundy, was acquitted of all charges in October. But he and others have also been charged in a 2014 standoff in Bunkerville, Nevada. Now, that armed protest was led by Bundy's father, a 70-year-old cattle rancher named Cliven Bundy, who refused to pay more than $1 million in grazing fees over 20 years for his use of federal land. The first of three trials involving the Bunkerville standoff is going on now. Jenny Wilson is covering the trial for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. She joins us by Skype. Jenny, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
So there are these two cases here, so I think it's important for you to lay it out. Remind us what happened in this Bunkerville, Nevada standoff.
So in the Bunkerville case, it started about 20 years ago when Cliven Bundy stopped paying fees and was letting his cattle roam freely on hundreds of thousands of acres of federal land. The federal government tried over two decades to get him to either remove his cattle or pay his fees, and he refused. He would throw court orders out the window of his truck. He would mail a check to the Clark County government instead of the federal government. And eventually, the feds got a court order that would authorize the Bureau of Land Management to go in and round up the cattle and seize them to impound them.
And what was his argument? Why didn't he think he had to pay these fees?
So Bundy maintains that the local sheriff, rather than the federal government, has control over the lands in question. He thinks that the federal lands belong to, quote unquote, we the people. And that was why he mailed the check to Clark County. That was why when all of these protests were taking place, he kept looking to the sheriff for help. He fundamentally rejects the idea that the federal government has jurisdiction on these public lands in Nevada.
Okay. Tell us about the people who are facing charges, because I understand one of them is Eric Parker, who was photographed wearing body armor, laying on his stomach and aiming a rifle from a bridge at the protest.
Yeah, Eric Parker, and there's one other defendant in that case who was also photographed pointing that long gun through the crack in the Jersey barrier on the bridge. So the six people that are standing trial right now are who the government has described as gunmen. They're not people who really had any interest in the cattle grazing dispute, and to some extent, the federal land dispute, for that matter. But what they did do was they saw all these online postings, blogs, about what was going on, about the protests, and they decided for a multitude of reasons that their rights were being threatened. So they got in the cars and they drove from out of state to join the protests. When the standoff occurred on April 12th, 2014, they were, many of them, armed and wearing tactical gear. And some of them, as you said, photographed pointing the weapons through the crack in the Jersey barrier. They maintain that they thought the federal government was about to launch this mass attack on them and that they were acting the way they did for self-defense. The federal government obviously challenges that assertion.
Mm. And there may be some sympathy there in Nevada. Last year, I was in Bunkerville right around the election, and I did an interview with the town's constable, Eric Laub, who knows the Bundy family well. And we were talking about the election, and Laub drew a comparison to Cliven Bundy and Donald Trump because, you know, in his mind, both men have taken firm stances against bureaucrats and politicians in Washington.
The gut feeling is that there's a lot of people that would agree with Cliven and agree with Donald Trump. that something needs to be done.
So, Jenny, we see this attitude in the West a lot. We saw it lead to an acquittal in the Oregon case. Are we at a time and in a place where the same thing could happen in Nevada in this trial with Cliven Bundy?
It certainly could happen in Nevada. I mean, this is a trial that's very ideological in nature. It divides people who are on the either ends of the political scale. So in a case like this, when you have 12 jurors and you need all 12 to go one way in order to acquit or to convict, and anything less than that is a hung jury, there's always the possibility. Anything could happen. But what we did see during jury selection is that wide range of ideas on this issue and the wide range of opinions on this issue just from the jury pool out here in Las Vegas.
Are Cliven Bundy's cattle still grazing for free on federal land?
Cliven Bundy's cattle are still grazing. They ceased operations back in 2014. They did eventually leave the standoff. As the prosecutor has said, they chose safety over cattle. So the cattle are still there, to my knowledge.
Jenny Wilson, reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington today, ahead of his first official White House meeting with President Trump tomorrow. The Obama administration ended on frosty terms with Netanyahu when it allowed the UN Security Council to condemn construction of Israeli settlements in the West Bank. That prompted then-President-elect Trump to say that things will be different after January 20th. But will they? Let's bring in Daniel Kurtzer. He was U.S. ambassador to Israel during the George W. Bush administration. He's professor of Middle East policy studies at Princeton University, and he's also been critical of Donald Trump's pick for U.S. ambassador to Israel, David Friedman. Ambassador, given the recent turmoil with Israel, can you put this week's visit into context?
Well, on the one hand, both Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu will have reason to demonstrate harmony and change. And so no matter what they talk about, they're going to come out of their meeting shaking hands and smiling. But it really covers over some turmoil that both of them are experiencing with respect to policy, personnel, and politics. You have the Michael Flynn resignation and turmoil within the White House staff. And Netanyahu faces very severe cabinet coalition crisis back home, as well as uncertainty about what that's going to mean for his own political future, given the fact that he's under investigation for some financial issues.
Well, how will the Michael Flynn resignation affect the U.S.-Israel relationship?
Well, in the long term, it won't. But in the short term, the National Security Advisor is supposed to coordinate the U.S. side of this visit. In other words, put all the papers together, make sure the interagency process is working, get the president up to speed. And when the National Security Advisor walks out the day before an important visit, there's got to be chaos right now, just finding things. Where are the briefing books? Where are the talking points? So in the short term, it's really quite detrimental to the success of the visit. Over the long term, they'll fill in the space with somebody else who hopefully will do a more efficient job.
Well, before he got on his plane, Prime Minister Netanyahu told reporters that the alliance between Israel and the U.S. has always been, quote, extremely strong and is about to get even stronger. Let's listen.
President Trump and I see eye to eye on the dangers emanating from the region, but also on the opportunities. And we'll talk about both, as well as upgrading the relations between Israel and the United States in many, many fields.
Ambassador, you mentioned some of the pressures that Netanyahu is feeling at home. Could you go into that a little bit more?
Sure. He's got political pressure from his right. His is a right-wing coalition, and those members of the coalition were buoyed by Mr. Trump's victory, thinking that it gave them a green light to build more settlements and maybe even annex some of the territories that Israel has occupied since 1967. Netanyahu will want to curb that appetite, knowing that any actions like that could really upset the apple cart with Washington. He also has a legal issue in which he's being investigated for some very serious allegations of gift-taking and bribery and things like that. And in the past, we know that that has brought down previous Israeli leaders. Ehud Olmert is sitting in jail. So it's not easy for Netanyahu as he leaves home, and he certainly will want to demonstrate to his own population that the U.S. relationship is solid and sound and that he is the best person to oversee that relationship. Mm.
And there was also this apparent shift by the Trump administration recently, because during the campaign, Trump had said that Israel should go ahead with those settlements that you mentioned. But then, of course, this month, we know that he told an Israeli paper that the settlements don't help the peace process. So that must have been a surprise to Netanyahu and to Israelis. But why do you think the president was shifting his position like that?
Well, Peter, there's two possibilities. One is that this is a concerted strategy to keep the prime minister a little bit off balance and to not have him perceive that there's a green light to do things that actually the president doesn't want him to do. And the other possibility, which actually I believe, is that the administration is debating within itself what to do. And depending on the day, the president tweets out a policy or the White House puts out a statement. Not necessarily all in concert with each other.
Hmm. It's also interesting because you have to square that policy shift with his pick for the person to take your old job, David Friedman. The nominee to U.S. ambassador to Israel will go before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee later this week. He has also been a huge backer of settlements in the West Bank, and he has dismissed a two-state solution with Palestinians. So on the one hand, you have the president softening some of his tones on the settlements. On the other hand, his pick to be the ambassador says something different.
It's a very strange choice. Mr. Friedman is obviously close to Mr. Trump, having served as his bankruptcy lawyer for a number of years. But it's not just a question of his not having experience. One can learn on the job. But Mr. Friedman has demonstrated some very radical views, and he has had some really nasty words to say for parts of the American Jewish community, calling supporters of J Street, for example, capos, the Jews who collaborated with the Nazis during the Holocaust. And I think Mr. Trump would be well advised to return Mr. Friedman to his role as a bankruptcy lawyer and pick somebody a little bit more moderate for a very challenging diplomatic assignment.
But doesn't it mirror some of the politics that are happening in Israel on the far right that are posing a challenge to Benjamin Netanyahu? And also, you know, the similar things we're seeing in the United States with the politics moving to the right.
Oh, I think that's right. But this is, you know, more than just a politics move. This is a diplomatic move. Very often, the United States and Israel have had a political channel to the White House, whereas the formal diplomacy was kept separate from that. Putting Mr. Friedman into this role, which mixes and mashes together politics and diplomacy, is really a recipe for very serious problems.
Mm. Well, we also expect Iran to be a big part of this meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump. What do you expect there?
I think Iran will probably be number one on Mr. Netanyahu's agenda. You know, you recall he fought very hard against it, pushed the Congress to try to overturn the agreement after the president and the other members of the P5 plus one had negotiated it. I think Mr. Trump, although he campaigned on a promise of undoing the agreement, is probably rethinking that and probably thinking more about how do I put pressure on Iran? And I think the two leaders in their meeting can actually find some meeting ground with respect to that kind of pressure, moving at the UN and other places to make sure that Iran understands that there will be consequences for aggressive action while holding their feet to the fire with zero tolerance for infractions with respect to the nuclear accord.
It makes you think, perhaps, that campaigning on the issue of Israel is quite different than the act of leading on the issue of Israel.
I think every candidate for a president has been far more aggressive and, I would say, pro-Israel than every president who's been elected. You take, for example, the question of settlements. One would have thought that Mr. Trump would have come in and immediately said settlements are fine, immediately moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. Mm. But the reality of governing has convinced even him, at least for the time being, to go a little more slowly. And I think it's a lesson that he has assimilated very quickly, both on this issue and on several other issues.
Daniel Kurtzer, U.S. ambassador to Israel during the George W. Bush administration, also professor of Middle East policy studies at Princeton University. Ambassador, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Several Trump administration officials are heading to Europe this week to attend the Munich Security Conference and to plan the president's trip to the G20 summit in Germany later this summer. Meanwhile, European allies are trying to find their footing with the new Trump administration. For the EU's top diplomat, that means reminding the U.S. that it's better to work together on key areas. NPR's Michelle Kellerman caught up with her on a recent trip to Washington.
President Trump is a big proponent of Brexit, the British decision to leave the EU. There are rumors he could even tap an EU skeptic as ambassador to the union. That was one topic the EU's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, raised as she made the rounds in Washington.
I was told there is no decision taken on the next U.S. ambassador to the European Union. I made clear that our procedures require the active consent of all the 28 member states of the European Union for the accreditation of an ambassador, and that has to be taken into consideration.
Mogherini used to work well with the Obama administration, which supported European integration. She's taking a more business-like approach with this White House and drawing some clear lines.
We do not interfere in U.S. politics. You might see this happening from other parts of the world. You would never see this happening from Europe. And Europeans expect that America does not interfere in European politics.
The European Union's foreign policy chief met with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, as well as several White House advisors, including President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. He's taking the lead on Middle East policy, and Mogherini says she talked to him about the possibility of reviving Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. She's also pressing the Trump administration not to walk away from the nuclear deal with Iran, which she oversees.
The deal is working, and we need to preserve it this way. And I was reassured by what I heard in my meetings on the intention to stick to the full, strict implementation of the agreement in all its parts.
Mogherini told reporters she also got reassurances from the Trump administration that the U.S. will continue to push Russia to implement an international peace plan on Ukraine before easing sanctions. The White House won't go that far on record, though, and the State Department didn't even issue a statement about Tillerson's meeting with Europe's top diplomat. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist. From politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
Airbnb is trying to spread its reach beyond home sharing. Last week, Bloomberg News reported that Airbnb is in the process of buying Luxury Retreats. That's a vacation home management company in Montreal. And also, according to Bloomberg, Airbnb is trying to get into booking flights and planning itineraries to get a foothold in the luxury travel industry. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us from New York. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Robin.
So buying a luxury home management company feels like it makes sense to me. And I mean, I'm guessing people might want help managing Airbnb rentals. Is that the thinking?
Well, Bloomberg's Olivia Zaleski has done a lot of good reporting on Airbnb. And basically, what the company is trying to do is become sort of a one-stop destination for people planning their entire vacation. So that not only includes managing luxury homes like this, but also, like you said, they want to offer things like booking flights and restaurant reservations, adding tours, and planning vacation itineraries from beginning to end in a way that in which they give users sort of a personalized itinerary and suggestions based on, where they're going and what their past trips have been like. So it's a pretty wide-ranging strategy that they're trying to expand on here.
Does that make them then more like Expedia or Cheap Tickets? And does that then move them away from what they are, which is it's sort of a do-it-yourself thing where I don't know if fees might be involved if people are asking them to plan their whole trip?
Yeah, it definitely makes them a more comprehensive service. And I think it's safe to say that they would compete pretty directly with travel sites like Expedia and similar sites. They're also trying to put sort of their own unique offerings on the table. For example, offering trips to London where you can go to a hat-making class and a trip to South Africa where you can go on a coffee roasting trip. So they're trying to sort of carve out a niche of these unique type of vacations like that.
Well, that sounds like a travel agent. It's funny if we're going back full circle to travel agencies.
Right.
But is this because of pressure they're getting? There are a lot of people who don't like the fact that people are renting their apartments in, you know, in a building to complete strangers. There's a new law that's imposing fines on hosts for illegal rentals on Airbnb. There's also pressure in London, San Francisco. Officials say some rentals violate the zoning laws, as I mentioned, displaced residents. So are they being forced to diversify?
I'm not sure if it's forced, but if you look at how big this company has gotten, its private market valuation is about $31 billion. That's a very big company. So I think just based on that alone, it makes sense to try to diversify to begin with. But when your core business does have these legal risks, like you mentioned, then that really, you know, makes it an even smarter and makes a lot more sense to try to diversify like this.
Yeah. And by the way, I mentioned the fines on illegal rentals. That's in New York. Well, you talk about how big this company is. They're pursuing an IPO in the next year or so. How is the company doing financially and raising money from investors?
They're doing pretty well. They became profitable in the second half of last year. Their revenue increased more than 80% in the year. They expect to be profitable again this year. And what's remarkable to me, they've raised more than $1 billion in capital. And according to Bloomberg's reporting, they still have nearly all of it. So they're doing pretty well.
Yeah, Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks.
Thank you.
On the campaign trail, Donald Trump promised to bring back manufacturing jobs. But according to the job search site Indeed, manufacturing jobs are at an all-time low, 8.5% compared to 30% in the 1950s, which made us think of traditional lunch pail working-class men. Here are some of the headlines. An Atlantic piece is titled "The End of Men" and asks, what if modern post-industrial society is simply better suited to women? Betsy Stevenson wrote in Bloomberg, manly men need to do more girly jobs. The Boston Globe piece was titled "The End of Manly Labor." Lance Coppa is a professor at Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations. He joins us by Skype. Lance, which headline do you prefer? Manly labor is dead, or men just need to take jobs that were traditionally for women, like nursing jobs? Or is it just their tough luck right now that historically they had the jobs and now women are better suited for the jobs that there are?
No, I don't agree with any of those. The death of manufacturing is greatly exaggerated. You know, it's true that it's declined as a share, as a percentage of the overall economy and as a percentage of the labor force. But there are still 12 million manufacturing jobs in the United States. You drive along the interstate highways and you'll see big manufacturing facilities all over the country. The other thing is that at any given moment in time, including right now, I just looked it up, there are 300,000 openings in manufacturing, job openings for applicants. And the manufacturing sector is actually doing quite well and could do even better if the plans for infrastructure improvements come into place.
Well, everybody's hoping that. But what are we missing then? Because we read also that of the 227,000 new jobs created in January, only 5,000 were in manufacturing. You're saying that they're there already. So what's the disconnect? You have voters who said that they, you know, were out of work and they were counting on Donald Trump to bring work back. And you have job openings.
You know, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate it in the other direction either. The thing is, there's a skills match that needs to be achieved. My own background is an example. When I was growing up in Rochester, New York, 50,000 people worked for Eastman Kodak.
Yep.
Now it's about 1,000. Does that mean that 49,000 people went out on the street with nothing? No. In fact, the engineers and other people that had worked for Kodak started up dozens and dozens of smaller specialized companies, and they hire a lot of people. Those jobs in manufacturing can be there, but you can't just walk out of high school with a high school degree and nothing else and get a good manufacturing job. There is a skills need. And it doesn't mean they have to be licensed electricians or plumbers or something. there are a lot of men, working class men, who they don't have a knack for school, say, the patience to sit down, and they don't do standardized tests well. But they're smart and they're resourceful, and they can find careers in these niche manufacturing markets, I think.
Well, here you come to what seems like another disconnect, because while Donald Trump is saying, I'm going to bring back these, you know, we're going to pour steel, you know, we're hearing from people, well, you're probably not, because it's done so much cheaper in other countries. And people who work with steel, we've been talking to pipeline makers, they buy it in bulk from other countries and then they work with it. But the Democrats have always said, we're going to retrain, that people need to be retrained. You talk about there's skilled jobs that are available. And, you know, we hear from so many, including Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan, who spoke to NPR. And he said, you know, my people don't want to get retrained. They don't want to run a computer. As you said, some people just aren't great in school. I know and love many of them. As Tim Ryan said, they want to run a backhoe. They want to build things. They want to get their hands on things. Are those jobs there?
I think they are. I mean, I don't want to paint a completely rosy scenario that, oh, yeah, no problem, nothing to worry about. There's plenty to worry about. But I think that working class men who, you know, don't have the bent for high tech or advanced education and so on. First of all, there's a lot of jobs in manufacturing still out there. There's a whole cohort of baby boom workers in manufacturing that are going to be leaving their jobs in the next few years. That's going to create lots of openings. There's also a whole sector of what's come to be called logistics, truck driving, retail deliveries, warehouse work. These are actually millions of jobs. They're not counted as manufacturing because they come under materials handling and transportation, you know, for the truck drivers and so on. But these are millions of jobs that working class men and women, too, they can do without a particularly advanced education or high technical training. The point is they need to be good jobs, not lousy jobs. Right now, those jobs are paying $10, $12, $14 an hour. They should be getting $20 or $25 an hour for those jobs. And that requires, I think, more attention to the right to organize trade unions and to bargain collectively. I think that's got to be the way to advance wages and conditions in these other sectors that, in fact, do employ millions of working class men.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because that's exactly the opposite of what the Republicans and President Trump say. They believe that it's the other direction that leads back to jobs, away from unions, away from collective bargaining, that frees up business to hire more people, but maybe at a lesser wage.
No, I don't accept that. History teaches a very valuable lesson that wages and working conditions advance when workers' right to organize and bargain collectively is itself advanced and protected.
Yeah, you've also been quoted as saying that some of the issues that Democrats push, raising the minimum wage, improving family leave, this group of, and I'm saying men because it has traditionally been men, who's, you know, for several generations, they've lifted things, they've moved things. They, you know, the pride in their bodies and the dignity of putting a roof over the heads of their families and feeding their families through their sweat has been passed down for generations. And you said that for them, those are more of new working class issues. What do you mean by that?
Well, take the minimum wage, for example. I think it's vitally important to increase the minimum wage around the country. And we see it being done all over the country at state and local levels. We still need a substantial increase in the federal minimum wage. But for a lot of working class men, working at a minimum wage job is insulting. And family leave is important, but there are still a lot of people in traditional family settings, and it might be great, you know, if the woman in the relationship or one woman in the relationship can get time off and so on. But the men are interested in, like, going out to work to support their family. You know, I think that has to be recognized. And again, it comes down to making the jobs that working class men can now get into. And, you know, it's a good thing that it's not all heavy labor. In fact, working class men call it bulwark. You know, there's not so much bulwark anymore. And that's a good thing. And I think working class men, you know, need to get over some of the hang-ups and the traditionalist notions and be ready to go into caring professions. You know, there are a lot of jobs in nursing homes and care facilities and hospitals that actually do require a lot of physical strength.
I'm looking at a picture of the great artwork from the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, when, you know, out of work, unemployed men were put to work on all these building projects. There's this beautiful mural by Seymour Fogel. It's called The Wealth of the Nation. I'm sure you've seen it. And you see, there's a man, they're all men, obviously, 1930s. Mm-hmm. There's a man kneeling and looking at a blueprint, and there's another looking through a microscope. But there's a man with a sledgehammer over his brawny shoulder and another with his work pail and another his brawny arms, you know, the muscles exposed as he pulls a lever on some, on some machinery. You know, look, I can see somebody who has worked in labor for years listening to us and saying, what are you, crazy? I don't miss that at all. But we're not romanticizing this. There is a group of men who very much love that, you know, physical. You know, they don't want it to be streamlined, right? This group that really does want to do hard, sweaty labor.
I don't know about the hard, sweaty part. I mean, I don't accept that there are all these guys out there that, you know, want to swing a sledgehammer. There might be some, but if the only, I mean, it would be a terrible thing, I think, if there were millions of opportunities for men to swing sledgehammers. It's just not going to happen. This vision that Donald Trump has of bringing back the steel mill that employs 30,000 people is completely ridiculous.
It may be a romanticizing of that swinging the sledgehammer by people who've never done it.
Yeah, I think there's probably some of that. The thing is, I mean, I'm happy that the sledgehammer jobs aren't there anymore because, for one thing, bodies would break down. You know, the working class men who are strong in their 20s and 30s, their bodies would break down by the time they're in their 40s. And then you're talking about disability and Social Security.
And a complete loss of dignity.
Yeah.
That's Lance Kampa, a professor at Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Happy to join you today.
It's here and now. U.S. businesses are preparing for major shifts to American trade policy under President Trump. He's promised to renegotiate or scrap NAFTA. But yesterday at a press conference with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, he said this about the deal.
We'll be tweaking it. We'll be doing certain things that are going to benefit both of our countries. It's a much less severe situation than what's taken place on the southern border. On the southern border, for many, many years, the transaction was not fair to the United States. It was an extremely unfair transaction.
Well, American cattle ranchers are closely watching this play out because beef exports to Mexico have boomed since NAFTA started in 1994. Kevin Kester is a fifth-generation rancher and the incoming president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So we've got you on a landline there, in part because you are in Parkfield, California, on your ranch. It's a very remote part of California. I see that you've got about 18 people living in Parkfield.
That's what the sign says. I'm not quite sure where they all live, but the sign does say population 18.
Well, tell me about your operation out there.
Sure. My family's been ranching in this central coast area of California since the 1860s, and as you noted, I represent the fifth generation of my family to ranch here, and I'm proud to say that we have a young granddaughter who represents the seventh generation on the ranch, and we're looking forward to trying to keep the ranch viable for future generations.
Well, to keep it viable, trade is very important to your business. The largest foreign buyer of U.S. beef is Mexico. How does it work? How does cattle from a ranch like yours make its way south?
Right. Exports are hugely important to the beef industry and specifically to my own family cattle operation. Probably close to 15% of our value of each and every heifer or steer that we ship off the ranch here is represented in our beef export market. So we also historically have purchased Mexican calves and crossed them into the U.S. and raised them up here on the ranch. And then we grow them into steaks, and they get shipped back overseas. So it's a completely global enterprise here, and exports are a huge component of that to keep us in business.
So if exports are such a big deal, you say about 15% of the cost of a heifer, what do you make of President Trump's promise to make significant changes to NAFTA, especially vis-a-vis Mexico?
I watched the news conference with the Prime Minister of Canada and President Trump, And I was encouraged by the words that our president used, that he was going to tweak NAFTA and not necessarily just turn it upside down, because especially in the cattle industry, we're huge winners in the current NAFTA. And we don't want to disrupt trade to either country, Mexico or Canada, because it would be harmful to our family business, but literally thousands and thousands of family-run ranches and farms across the nation. So it's important, if the president wants to reopen NAFTA, to tweak it and bring it up to today's technology. I think we could support that and work with the administration to make sure that as they do that, they don't accidentally or unintentionally create issues for the programs that are very successful under NAFTA.
But the word that the president used, tweak, was actually quite softer than a lot of the languages that he has used over the last several months, especially during his campaign. He's had a difficult relationship with Mexico's president already. And for you, I gather, in the beef industry, this is critical because you have a supply problem. The U.S. cattle inventory is growing. The USDA forecasts that domestic production will go up to 26 billion pounds this year. That's the highest level since 2011. How critical is the export market for you to avoid oversupply?
I can't overstate how critical and important our export market of U.S. beef across the world is to keep prices up for U.S. producers of beef. So we are going to work really hard with the administration and identify those opportunities to where it doesn't take, hopefully, 5 years to do a bilateral trade agreement. We can work faster and quickly. I don't want to see any disrupted trade, so I hope we don't go down the road of scrapping NAFTA. But if it comes to that, we'll take those opportunities to work with the administration and come to a successful conclusion, no matter which direction President Trump decides he wants to go.
A lot of cattle ranching happens in red conservative states. You're there in California, but I wonder, did you support Donald Trump in the election?
Well, yes. I think a lot of our ranchers and farmers across the nation did support the president and his administration.
So I just got to ask, I wonder if a lot of cattle ranchers are getting nervous with Trump's stance on NAFTA.
Yeah, anytime there's change, I think it's human nature to be nervous when there's uncertainty about what's going to happen into the future. So that's why it's even really important for us to develop the relationships in Washington, D.C., and work together to be successful in our trade efforts.
All right. Kevin Kester, incoming president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, on the line with us from his ranch in Parkfield, California. Kevin, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.